Hey y'all, it's Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm a board-certified gynecologist, a clinical assistant professor of OBGYN at Northwestern Feinberg School of Medicine, and owner of a private practice for almost a decade that specializes in menopause and sexual medicine. I'm a South Asian American Muslim woman who is here to empower, educate, and help you advocate for health issues that have been stigmatized, shamed, and perhaps even prevented you from living your best life. I'm better than your best girlfriend and more open than most of your doctors. I'm here to educate so you can advocate. Welcome to Gyno Girl Presents Sex, Drugs, and Hormones. Let's go. Hey, y'all. It's me, Dr. Samina Rahman, Gyno Girl. I'm so excited. I just completed a podcast with Dr. Sarah Cigna. She is an amazing educator at George Washington University Medical Center. She's an assistant professor of OBGYN and a board-certified gynecologist. She has started the first ever female sexual medicine fellowship for OBGYNs in the country, which is huge. It is huge, guys. I mean, there is no way that academic centers usually integrate this into their program. So this is really big deal that she did. And hopefully through this education, more patients will be able to get treated around the world. She's hoping to start other fellowships around the country or help start fellowships around the country for others that are interested, and kind of talks about how she went about doing it and what inspired her to do it. So this is really at an administrative level, learning, you know, how advocacy works in your favor, especially if you're advocating for your patients. So I hope you enjoy this episode on how Dr. Sarah Cigna started the first ever female sexual medicine fellowship in OBGYN in George Washington University Medical Center at the SAGA Center, the Sexual Health and Gender Affirming Care Center. It's amazing what she did, and her story is awesome. And really, if you're interested in medicine, if you're a patient interested in getting treated, or if you're interested in sexual medicine, either as a student or a resident, this story will tell you, you know, kind of how you can get more involved as well. So please tune in. Thanks. Thanks for joining us today for another podcast. Today, I'm super excited. I have a friend and colleague that we're going to be speaking to about sexual medicine and advocacy. And we're going to be speaking about sexual medicine as a career choice and advocacy, and how we need more sexual medicine training in the world. So please welcome Dr. Sarah Cigna. Dr. Sarah Cigna is a board-certified OBGYN and an assistant professor of OBGYN with the George Washington Medical Faculty Associates. She is the current director of SAGA, which is the Sexual Health and Gender Affirmation Center, and the director of the first ever sexual medicine fellowship in the country for OBGYN physicians. She was born and raised in Maryland and has done all of her education in that area, college at the University of Maryland, as well as she finished a master's in physiology at George Washington University. She completed medical school at George Washington University, and she did her residency at George Washington University. So she is a lifer, as we say. And she is an International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health, which is ISHWISH, which is the organization I talk about a lot on the show, and is the upcoming educational chair for the educational committee for ISHWISH, which is very exciting. And she's also involved in many other organizations, the International Society for Sexual Medicine, the OBGYN Academic Specialist Society, which is SASGOG, and she's also part of APGO, which is the Association of Professors of Gynecology and Obstetrics, as well as doing many, many, many other things. So welcome, Sarah.
Too many.
We're all about balancing around here.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you so much for having me on.
Yeah, I'm so excited about this because a lot of what we talk about and my tagline is I'm here to educate so you can advocate. So I love that the basis of everything you're doing is really about patient advocacy and how, you know, you've come such a long way and done something amazing that many of us, I used to work in academics, I wouldn't have been able to dream of doing what you've done. So it's really bravo. We're going to talk about what a difficult thing that is that you did by starting a sexual medicine center for OBGYN. But let's just first talk about, like, what is sexual medicine, why it's important, and when we can go on and talk about how we just don't learn it in medical school or residency.
Absolutely. You know, when I was little, I always wanted to be a teacher. And the realization that the word doctor comes from docere, which means teaching, was like the biggest kind of, I don't know, light bulb moment for me when I was like, oh, I'm like in exactly the right profession.
Right.
Because it's that perfect mix of like science and teaching. And
yes.
Going through training, you know, you have this path set in front of you in medicine. And first you do this, then you do this, then you, you know, then you go to residency, right? And it's all kind of laid out. And then all of a sudden you graduate and you're like, okay, now what do I do? And finding the mentorship to figure out what your path is going to be, especially as an academic generalist, is challenging.
It's very
because
challenging.
There's so many options, right? It's like the world's your oyster. But I got into sexual medicine even as a med student. It was when I was first exposed by my mentor, Andrew Goldstein, who is always so generous with his knowledge and, you know, welcoming people in to shadow and learn more.
Well, he started the Center for Vulvovaginal Diseases, CVVD. Is that right?
CVVD. Yep, exactly. And, you know, is like a world expert on women's sexual pain, as well as, you know, vulvar germ disorders and vaginitis. And, you know, I learned so much from him and realized very quickly, like, but why didn't I learn it anywhere else?
Right.
You know, like why there's this whole body of knowledge,
yes,
and this huge community of healthcare providers that all of a sudden I'm like, wait a minute, I haven't heard about any of this before. How is that possible?
Mm-hmm.
So as I went through training and realized, like, well, I want to do this with my life. It's too fun.
Yeah.
The patients are amazing. I learned so much from them, right? Each individual has a lived expertise in what their conditions are and what they've gone through. And I, you know, getting into being an attending, realized very quickly, like, so many people want mentorship.
Mm-hmm.
So many people are craving this education, but not just going to a course, right?
Yeah.
Going to a course is a great first step, but to really get the mentorship in the nuance for really complex patients,
yeah,
you need apprenticeships, right?
Absolutely.
You need time and you need variation, you need repetition, just like residency,
right,
or other clinical apprenticeships are like lots of repetition with different nuance.
Yes.
And so, I mean, that's really what drove me. My dream was to have a fellowship. My dream was to have residents be doing a rotation. And with the help of my team members, who I could not do this without, we've actually done it. You know, at GW now we have a two-week rotation that every single OBGYN resident does in their third year. And they do sexual medicine and they also do gender affirmation care. So they I mean, it's not nearly enough,
right,
to really practice it in a full scope way, but at least they get a taste of it, appreciation.
Which most of us didn't get to see. We graduate without knowing how to treat sexual pain or any of this, which brings us to, like, you know, what's happening? How are sexual medicine doctors even learning this? Like, what does the data say about, you know, how many OBGYNs or I don't even know about you. I know there's been data on OBGYNs and how little they get.
There's a study looking at OBGYN residents in the United States, and it's actually a pretty good sample nationwide. I can't remember the exact number of residents that were in there, but what they showed is that while over two-thirds of the programs that residents were responding from did value sexual health as an important part of their education, a very, very small percentage of those people were able to really give answers to actual questions about sexual health when you looked at the actual content.
Sure, I think exactly. It was a vignette-based study, like where they looked at vignettes. Yeah, I think it was over 4,000 residents that they interviewed.
It was a lot. Yeah. And it just right. showed the gap, right? It's like, okay, everyone thinks this is important,
yeah,
but we're not actually teaching it. And the reason we're not actually teaching it is because we don't have people in these academic spaces who really are able to get their hands on
right.
every single learner that walks in the door in a standard way, right? It's the people who are interested, the people who kind of like yeah. push for more experience that really get that, but not,
absolutely,
you know, we really need to
absolutely.
Be doing this for everyone.
And I think that's a big take-home message here is that, you know, I think in one of my first podcasts, I talked about my journey into trying to get sexual medicine training which most of us have to do through the International Society for the Study of Women's Sexual Health. I spent some time with Dr. Erwin Goldstein. You know, it's like you have to seek out this mentorship and you have to like go above and beyond to get the information you need. And I'm lucky that we're lucky we have ISHWSH as a society, I think, because, you know, and the same with the Menopause Society. I mean, there's these like sub-specialty societies that exist. IPPS, which is the International Society for the Study of Pelvic Pain. And so I feel like, you know, based on the fact that we have these, at least they're the people that are doing the research, the people that are seeing the patients are able to then help us gain that knowledge. Those of us that are on, you know, on the front lines, seeing patients in either academics or private practice or whatever the case may be. And I think that's where the missing gap is, because most of us didn't. We graduated from, you know, a residency and maybe saw one vaginismus patient or, you know, and that's all they said. It was vaginismus. That's, you know, pelvic floor, if that, you know, a lot of them even got ignored in the process. So, and I think this is the frustration of why patient advocacy groups have evolved, because patients are tired of going from doctor to doctor to doctor and not getting answers. And then in the process, getting gaslit, I guess you'd say, you know, in terms of their symptoms and what they should expect.
Yeah, the number of patients who, you know, say that they've been told everything looks normal. You know, well, everything doesn't feel normal, you know, and they're just, they're appropriately fed up. Our system's inability to really care for them. And the only way to fix that is to start educating people from the very beginning. So my partner, Anita McLenney, and I have this infiltration plan. Like we literally have a document that we've laid out. Like, how are we going to make this an infusion of these really important topics from the very beginning, from medical school? So we give lectures to the medical students, even in their preclinical years, about sexual health. And it's not everything, right? There's, I mean, the fellowship's a year. It's a lot of information to get into somebody, but just giving them the little tidbits to make their brains start thinking about this as a medical problem and thinking beyond it's in their head, right? Because we know that that's not true.
Right, exactly. And we always talk about there's a biopsychosocial approach to all of these things. So it's important for at least them to know the way that we attack some of these issues and, you know, even getting that baseline. And at, to their point, there are students that have been frustrated about it, right? They created the students, medical students in the Chicago area started the Medical Student Forum, which is a forum for students to learn sexual medicine. So, and that forum has been doing amazing things. They have a symposium every January and, you know, they do amazing things to educate themselves. They you know, recruit different doctors to come talk about different topics. And so at the end of the day, if you can't get it from your administration, like people just get pissed off enough and don't.
Like, exactly.
Which is what, you know, what happens with patients all the time. They form all these little advocacy groups like tight-lipped or endo warriors or, you know, all these different groups.
I'm really hopeful because there's so much momentum right now for this with all of the advocacy that's happening around menopause. That's like such a great segue into this. Yes. And I think that the voices are starting to be heard, especially thanks to social media. I mean, without social media, the sexual medicine community, I mean, where would we be? Like, we were so disconnected. We're kind of scattered all over the country. And
it's great that we go to these con- That's where I met Sarah for the first time, was like maybe 5 or 6 years ago at ISHWSH. And that's what we do. We connect and we talk about patients with each other. And, you know, we're a network. We have our forum within the ISHWSH community that you can present difficult patients to. Yep. And, you know, a lot of it because we don't have enough research and we don't have enough data for a lot of what we do, which is changing. I think that trying to stay within, you know, the academic community and trying to understand that is really amazing. Tell us some of the hiccups that, like, how did, so you had this idea, right? I mean, I used to work in academics before I started private practice. So I know that there's so many challenges on, you know, levels of administration. Anytime you work for a big healthcare organization, whether or not it's an academic or not, it's, there's a lot of paperwork and there's a lot of red tape, right? So how did you go about starting?
So I think part of it in academics, you have to create the demand that this is important. So that was my first goal, was to demonstrate to my leaders, right, the administration, the people that, you know, oversee kind of the full, the big picture of the OBGYN department.
Right.
and what kind of services we offer. Yeah. And I said, you know, I'm really interested in providing this type of care. And I was hoping to open a half day a week to dedicate to that type of care. And they said, okay, sure. And so I, you know, I did it. You got to fill your schedule, right? Because in academics, you got to make sure that you're reaching your productivity goals, et cetera, because that's always a concern in any kind of insurance-based model. And once that filled up and started spilling into the rest of my clinic, then I opened up another half day.
Yeah.
And then I opened up a full another day, you know, and then all of a sudden I was really seeing mostly sexual medicine patients, all the vaginal patients, and realized like, oh, there's actually even more demand than I anticipated. I had a waiting list of like months long, and suddenly I was able to recruit another physician, right? Recruit a nurse practitioner and, you know, get more people on my team to help me because I just couldn't even keep up with the number of patients that were coming in. And that demand for service is what really helped me kind of be able to go to bat for this community to my chair, you know, to my chair, to my division director and say, look, I really think this is important. Here are the things about the practice that I need help with, right? So I needed help with getting patients scheduled. I needed help with providing a little bit more of a safe bubble around communication with our office. Because a lot of these patients have undergone significant medical trauma, significant sexual trauma, significant trauma, right? Trauma, trauma, trauma. It's big T, it's little T, all of it. But it really makes it hard to pick up the phone and call when you don't know who's going to answer. If you're someone who's, you know, perhaps non-binary or trans, you don't know what pronouns they're going to assume you use, right? So there's all these pieces. We really wanted to provide a safe space. So we were able to negotiate some of these things once we showed there's demand for this, which there's demand everywhere in the country, but you know, you got to start little and slowly grow. You can't just open up all at once because, like you said, in academics, there's a lot of, I don't want to say regulation, but just kind of like structure that you kind of have to work in. Right. So it was really challenging. And I definitely had periods of time where I was very overwhelmed and feeling like, I don't know how I can make this work. But as soon as I felt that way and voiced it, someone would come in and say, oh, I can help with this part. I can, I want to do this part. And, you know, just the community that you build, it strengthens you, it strengthens the whole movement.
And so eventually you were able to get the center, right, opened up.
Yep.
And then it's a matter of getting, when we talk about fellowship training, it's really a matter of getting funding to, you know, get to pay for a fellow for the year and how that goes about, you know, from an administrative perspective.
Yeah.
But the fact of the matter is there's no OBGYN fellowship in the country. So what you did was huge. It's it's an amazing feat, actually. They have urologists have sexual medicine fellowships, but not for our own specialty, which, you know, it's so shocking. I mean, I know what urologists are treating men and women, obviously. And I think that's how the field evolved, right? Because it was Dr. Erwin Goldstein who was getting all these patients who's a urologist. And they kind of were like, well, what about us? What about us? And it was always like, aren't the gynies taking care of you? And unfortunately, we weren't. We weren't taking care of our own patients. So I'm, as a fellow gynecologist, I'm so proud that you did this because it's oftentimes, you know, it's frustrating to find out that does your own profession not care about this area of medicine that you're so passionate about and that patients suffer so much from. And I think that we just have such a big scope of what we do that it's hard to pick out some of these nuanced pieces of it, of medicine, to get people really to buy into it.
Yeah, the choice to call it a female sexual medicine fellowship was very intentional. You know, I run something that also takes care of a lot of people who don't identify as female. So, you know, recognizing that my partners on our team and I really talked about how are we going to differentiate this fellowship from any other sexual medicine fellowship that treats potentially all genders, right, in a urology group, but often really focuses on men's sexual health.
Yeah.
So whenever you Google just like sexual medicine, often it just kind of defaults to cis male sexual health. So, no, my focus in saying female was that it's not even just about people with vulvas and vaginas. It's also about people who identify as female, right? People who use she, her pronouns may not have that anatomy, but it doesn't matter. We're talking about people who don't fit into this cis male category that have a lot of resources available. We're focusing on pretty much everybody else.
Yeah.
So that was kind of the feeling there to really make sure that we're highlighting that we're doing the other, right? We're doing the less covered, the less advocated for, because that's what we need.
So tell us the full spectrum of stuff that's covered under the SAGA.
The Sexual Health and Gender Affirmation Center. So we like to joke and say there's the SAW and the GAW. So the SAW side, which is the sexual health side, is myself, Anita Michelinenni, and Emily Odenwald, a nurse practitioner that works with us. And the three of us do most of the sexual health care. And that is going to be things, a lot of pain, a lot of people with pain. I mean, the number of people with pain, it's just crushing because so many people walk around every day in excruciating pain. No one knows. They can't talk about it to anyone. So that's a lot of what we do. Probably 80% of our patients have some part of their spectrum of disorders is pain. Other things, vulvovaginal disorders, a lot of derm, a good amount of recurrent vaginitis, and sometimes vaginitis that isn't actually vaginitis, right? Things that end up being like muscle dysfunction, et cetera. And then we do quite a bit of warts, laser being for, you know, VIN, other vulvar derm and premalignant conditions. We partner with our oncologist. We partner a lot with our urogynecologist. We're very collaborative with our pelvic floor PTs. We do Botox injections. We do all the procedures, vestibulectomies, full scope. And then we do desire. We do orgasm. And that's my favorite part, when we get to like tinker with the pleasure part after we've gotten their pain better. That's always really rewarding to kind of allow people to take their pleasure back. And then the GA side of things, our gender affirmation side of the center, is led by Joey Bong, who uses they, them pronouns. And they are amazing. They came from Emory. They're totally pioneering gender affirmation care at our center and in our institution. So doing a lot of education around pronouns and kind of what it means to be non-binary or trans or whatever gender expansive identity someone has. And really providing the primary care and also prenatal care. So prenatal care for trans and non-binary patients is actually very hard to find, particularly in, you know, academic centers. It can be really challenging to find somewhere that's going to be have the inclusive space and also have the inner workings also be supportive of that. So Dr. Joey has been working tirelessly to educate all pieces of our system to make sure that patients that come through our labor and delivery also have a good experience with the pediatricians, with the pre-registration folks who are, you know, getting their information when they're registering, all of this, all of these little pieces.
Oh, that's amazing. Because that's the difficult part, I think, is even, you know, learning the right language to utilize to make it inclusive and you know, making sure that you're not, you know, alienating patients based on, you know, which way they feel.
And we're still working on that. Like it's, you know, it's all a work in progress. Like our whole, the whole system, it has to change.
That, yeah, absolutely. That's amazing. Do you have, and is there someone doing some of the surgeries as well within the center?
We have contacts in the city that do some surgeries. We do, you know, gender affirming hysterectomies. That's the main thing that we offer right now, but we'll hopefully, my dream again, dreaming, always on the next step, right? Next dream, got the fellowship. Now we're on to the next thing, would be to have some other specialties collaborate with us a little bit more closely within GW to be able to really allow patients to kind of ping pong around their different needs throughout their journey.
Amazing. Yeah. That would be ideal, actually. I think that's the hard part too, is finding all the, like when you're doing something that you need, it's multidisciplinary, you know, sexual medicine, the majority of it is multidisciplinary. No one person is curing your pain or your arousal or desire disorders. And so I think that's always been the challenge, is finding, okay, who's a good sex therapist that will fit for your patients? What about pelvic floor? You know, that kind of thing. So I'm glad that you're reaching out to more people in the DC area. And I think you have some great resources there as well. So it's amazing.
We're really lucky in DC. We have a really good network.
It's pretty expansive. That's awesome. And so you guys are pretty busy, it sounds like, too, right? Booked out.
Yes. We have to be, you know, careful of how quickly we bring people in, because we have to be able to take care of the people that we have. So sometimes the wait is a little bit, but, you know, it ebbs and flows like anything else. And, you know, the busy times, like, yes, it can be stressful, but at the same time, I'm grateful that we're able to help that, you know, that many more people.
And I would say, a lot of academic centers don't offer, you know, even a rotation. Like I'm affiliated with Northwestern, so I have students that don't rotate with me to get, and they're like, oh, we've never seen any of this, but it's not mandatory for them to do this.
Right.
The president's, it's not mandatory for them to do this. And when Northwestern had a center for sexual medicine and menopause before it kind of closed down, it still wasn't mandatory for, mm-hmm. you know, there were residents that still would graduate without ever seeing a menopause or sex med patient. So the fact that it's so integrated in the curriculum is really key, I think, and should be the model actually for students and residents. Cause I think that's the most frustrating part is like, well, I'm supposed to be able to take care of these patients and I can't, you know, like how, but I think that's what's driven most of us that don't have that fellowship, you know, training or whatever, that we had to go above and beyond to kind of work with our patients and do what's best for them.
Yeah. I feel like when we were kind of getting this opportunity to have a dedicated resident rotation, I mean, we jumped for it, right? Within 2 weeks, we had written up the objectives. We had figured out the assessment tools. Like, we just went crazy trying to make sure it happened. Uh-huh. And I think that, you know, we're planning to study it, right? We mm-hmm. got IRB in the works and making sure that we really document everything we're doing because we do want to be the model. We right. want to be a source of guidance and information for people who want to do the same thing. Because my goal isn't to be the only person who does this.
Right.
That's actually the opposite of my goal, right? I think I want everybody to be able to do this. And eventually, I hope all OBGYNs feel really comfortable at least doing the first steps of this kind of work. It's not hard, right? So much right. of it is listening. Literally, so much of it is just listening. I mean, the number of times that I say to patients at the end of our 30-minute talking, because yeah. they get two visits, we talk yeah. for 30 minutes, and then they come back, we do an exam. But at the end of the 30 minutes, I'm like, there's two things that you could have based on what you've told me. And like 99% of the time, it's one of those two things.
Right.
And, you know, it's rare that we get a patient where we're like, oh, we're really not sure. Like most patients, it's so clear just from their story, but you have to listen to the story. That's the key.
Exactly. And I think that's the problem that a lot of practices don't have the time, right? They're forced to see 40 patients a day. Yep. And, you know, yep. it's having worked in academics, I remember that where you had to see X number of patients and you had to get, and the same for any other hospital system. And I think that's why a lot of people that practice sexual medicine out in the field, like they don't take, I mean, I think, you know, that I take insurance for, yep. you know, at least, you know, 70% of my patients or whatever. But you know, it's not always easy, right? Like you don't get the reimbursement from insurances. It's hard to keep your, you know, mm-hmm. roof and or whatever, your overhead covered because, you know, they're not paying for sexual medicine. They don't consider it, you know, and so I think until that changes, which we are in the works, like you said, you know, there's more research being done. That initiative that came out of the White House recently yep. for more women's health research, you know, we're trying to get sex med in the middle of that as well. So I think that things are changing, but it really has to change a lot of it from the top down in order for people to feel like, you know, I'm going to get this care everywhere. Because we have so many what we call sexual medicine deserts, right? Where like there's no one there that can treat these conditions.
Yeah. So my goal with the fellowship is to like find, and hopefully when this podcast airs, someone is listening
yes.
that's interested. And, you know, I just want to find people in these deserts, right? Where there's just no one doing sexual health. And I want to pick them up out of their community. And I want to just like cocoon them for a yeah. year, really mm-hmm. hone their skills, mentor them so that they can do everything independently and then drop them right back into their environment with right. the mentorship from afar of actually starting that up, right? So I have two mentees who didn't do a fellowship, but they mm-hmm. did elective time with me and then spent additional time, you know, on their vacations or, you know, whenever they just wanted to come and learn. Yeah. And, you know, they're starting centers in their own institutions. There's one at mm-hmm. IU, Indiana University,
oh,
Will
wow.
Mary, and then Erin Deinhart is over in New Mexico, starting up there. Mary Alice Wolf is up in Boston. So like there are people starting to do this, but we can do a better job yeah. of really standardizing education so that mm-hmm. people feel really, you know, equipped with all the tools that they need to succeed.
Because I think that's always the frustration of patients. Like sometimes patients say, well, I actually, like they'll come to me after their sixth or seventh. And they're like, I think I have, you know, congenital neuroproliferative vestibulodyne. And I was like, well, let's talk about it. Like, how did you come to this? And they're like, well, you know, at some point you have to take ownership of your own health, which I know you're a big advocate of as well. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, our patients are forced to do this on so many levels yes. because their own clinicians don't know what's happening to them, right? So,
correct.
Which, you know, you can understand, like, this is someone that's supposed to help guide your healthcare or help manage your healthcare. and you know more about the condition than they do, which happens to so many of my patients. They're like, well, I knew this was happening, but she didn't agree with me. So blah, 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 you know? And so on the one hand, it's amazing that people advocate for themselves like that. But on the other hand, it's like, wow, they shouldn't have to do all that. They shouldn't have to do like work for this at all.
No. And for those listening who, you know, aren't really interested in doing this, you know, for their entire career and doing it every day, I mean, the patients love their GYNs, their primary care doctors, their psychiatrists, their therapists, their physical therapists, when they are referred appropriately to someone with more expertise, when that person doesn't know what to do next, right?
They'd love that.
Love them. And they go running right back because, you know, they feel the trust that, okay, my doctor may not have known exactly what to do for this situation, but they knew exactly where to send me. Right. So I think, you know, familiarizing yourself with the referral resources on the ISWISH provider directory and other provider directories for lichen sclerosis, for pudendal nerve, there's tons of patient websites that are really helpful that can guide people where do I send my patient?
Right. And if you're a patient that's listening, that's in the DC area, and like it's cost prohibitive for you to go to someone that might be in your area because, you know, they weren't able to take insurance or your insurance particularly, you know, there, I think you're one of the center. I actually don't know that there's that many other, because, you know, like I said, Northwestern used to have one, but they don't have one as anymore. And I feel like I know Tammy Rowan at the University of California in San Francisco is another person in academics that takes insurance.
Cleveland Clinic has a really good center. And actually, Rachel Pope is starting the second OBGYN sexual medicine fellowship starting next year. So,
amazing. I didn't know that.
Yeah. They just released their application a few weeks ago. So, I'm like, this is exactly what we need. It's just that we need it to just spread everywhere. There are definitely people around. Mainline Health, I think, just hired two people who do sexual health. So there's definitely places that are starting to pick up on the need for this.
Right. And our colleague in DC is affiliated with Kaiser. And, you know, Kaiser's another big hospital system.
Yes.
And they have, you know, sexual medicine through Kaiser in the DC area.
Yep.
I don't know if they have it in other Kaisers, but, you know, it's worth looking into because there's more and more of us that are interested in getting this ignited in different parts of the settings, academics, you know, hospital systems. And so, you know, there's going to be more options for patients that it is cost prohibitive to see, you know, maybe someone that wasn't able to take their insurance because, you know, they couldn't support their overhead with an insurance-based model or whatever the case may be. So if you're a student in medicine listening and you want to get involved with sexual medicine, you know, obviously I said that there is a forum called the Sexual Medicine Forum, but I know you probably take rotating students too, right, from other institutions.
Yeah, I took them more often pre-COVID. And since COVID, we've had a little bit of a change in kind of requirements for electives. So I'm actually in the works of making an official elective that will be recurring throughout the year so that it's much easier for people to apply. So that'll be probably coming out for the next academic year. We'll start accepting kind of like away rotation students.
Oh, amazing. Do you guys have mid-level provider training there too at Georgia GW? Do you have like an
NP? We have APPs, NPP, we have NPs, we have PAs. We don't have that level of training other than sort of like in the department. I definitely do a lot of education for our department, you know, whether it's faculty development lectures or just answering questions. You know, people are always, you know, calling, texting, asking questions about clinical things, which I'm always happy to educate. I try to send notes back to people so they can read, you know, what I did, what my reasoning was. But I mean, we really need fellowship and education for every single level, right? And every single kind of discipline. Mm-hmm. So we need endocrinologists who are knowledgeable at sexual health. We need spine surgeons. We need psychiatrists, which there's many psychiatrists already that are familiar with this. We need more immunologists now, right? This whole inflammation piece that's coming out, like, I mean, I have an immunologist that I hold very dear, and I sent her my patients when I'm like, something is going on with your immune system.
Yeah.
But we need more of these multidisciplinary folks who really understand the connection between everything so that we can really collaborate with them in a way that's informed.
Exactly. And so that's if you're a student and if you're a resident, do you take residents from other institutions as well?
I have in the past. Yeah. There's not like an official path, but if people reach out, I'm always happy to see if I can work with our leadership.
Okay. So potentially, if you have elective time and yep. you're an OBGYN resident, then you may be able to rotate with Dr. Cigna. Yep. And then obviously, once you graduate, if you're interested in this fellowship, then, you know, please apply, because we need more of you guys out there. And we need a lot more people doing the work. So, I mean, what you've done is no short of a, you know, miracle in so many ways, because it's not an easy task. So I want to commend you once again, because that's amazing. Dr. Cigna, I'm so proud of you.
I pinch myself every day because I still can't believe it's happening, but it's so exciting. Great.
Yeah. And so, you know, if you're, like I said, if you're a patient listening, you know, this is a great resource for you in the Washington, D.C. area. But I know you guys take, you have people flying in mm-hmm. from different parts of the country as well. And then, you know, if you're in, if you're studying to be either a doctor or a mid-level or, you know, anything, the resources are here. So also you should go to www.ishwish.org. There's a lot of resources for, you know, clinicians. And if you're a patient, you can go to www.prosayla.com. Yep.
Prosayla with a Y.
Yes. Prosayla. And that's our patient facing website that offers education written by sex med clinicians through Ishwish. But that's all we're going to talk about today. Dr. Cigna has done amazing work in advocating for patients as well as for education. So I'm so happy that she was able to tell the story and hopefully inspire those of you out there that are in academics, or, you know, that are students, or that maybe are, you know, patients that, you know, want to nudge your doctor to do something. You know, you can always do that as well. So, you know, we'll probably have you on again as things evolve, because I know that, you know, you're going to continue to do great stuff. But again, the Center for Sexual Health and Gender Affirming Care is at the George Washington University Medical Center. And Dr. Cigna is the director of the first ever sexual medicine fellowship in OBGYN. So thank you so much. And I'm so excited what all the work that you're doing, but I hope that we continue to do more across the country as Ishwish grows and as your organization grows. It's exciting to hear other things are popping up too for patients.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
All right. All right. Thanks, guys. Until next time, you know, we're here to educate so you can advocate. And this is Gyno Girl, and I will see you on the next episode.
If you have a second, please subscribe to this podcast. I'd love for you to be a follower and learn as much as you can about the things that we're going to talk about with all the people on our journey. Please review us on Apple or Spotify or wherever you listen to podcasts. These reviews really help. Review us, comment, tell me what else you want to hear to get more information. My practice website is www.cgcchicago.com. My website for Gyno Girl is www.gynogirltv.com. My Instagram is Gyno Girl, so please follow me for some good content. Additionally, I have a YouTube channel, Gyno Girl TV, where I love to talk about all these things on YouTube. And please subscribe to my newsletter, Gyno Girl News, which will be available on my website. I will see you next time.